Hey kids, before we get to a fresh episode of the Hashtag Am Writing podcast, I've got a thought for you. Are you the go-to in your writer's group for the kind of constructive criticism that people say helps them level up while still feeling like they're in charge? Has it kinda maybe occurred to you that you could get paid for that work, but you're not sure you're fully prepared or that you know how to get started? If that all sounds like you, you need to head over to bookcoaches.com/amwriting because Author Accelerator has a fantastic book coach training program that just might lead you to a side gig or a full-time business. You'll find all the info you need at bookcoaches.com/amwriting, along with frequently asked questions and a free video series to help you decide if book coaching is right for you.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I don't remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three.
Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Delantonio, and this is Hashtag Am Writing, the podcast about writing all the things, short things, long things, books, essays, pitches, proposals. This is the podcast about finding your way to sitting down and getting that work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and the forthcoming The Addiction Inoculation, yay, on April 6th. And you can find my work at Washington Post and New York Times, Atlantic, and Airmail.
I am KJ Delantonio. I am the author of The Chicken Sisters, out now in stores everywhere, as well as How to Be a Happier Parent. I'm the former editor and lead writer for the New York Times' Motherload blog. I'm still an occasional contributor there and in other places. And we have a guest with us today.
We do have a guest. We have, if you recall, we have spoken to this person before. She is the other princess because there is room for two princesses, as we discussed the last time she was here. Julie Lithcott-Hames is with us today. She is a lovely human being, a friend. She is the author of, well, her first book, How to Raise an Adult, that is just a fantastic resource for any parent. And she wrote the memoir Real American. And she has a new book coming out, which is, I'll let her tell you a little bit about, but it's going to be kind of a Bible of adulting. It's going to be like the adulting Bible. It's going to be pretty darn good. I cannot wait to get my hands on it. Julie, welcome to the show again.
Jess, thank you so much. KJ, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to hear your voices, and I get to actually see your faces, which none of your listeners can, but I get to, and I really like that. Thanks for having me back.
It's always very exciting. I wanted to have you back for a very, very specific reason. So we were talking a while back about your new book, and you talked about the fact, you were discussing the fact that you had been incredibly deliberate with your choice of sources and stories and making sure that this incredible book that you're creating reflects the lives of the people that you're writing it for and not just a narrow slice of life. And, you know, this discussion has come up a lot. Ed Yong in 2018, in February 6th, 2018 in The Atlantic, wrote an article called "I Spent 2 Years Trying to Fix the Gender Imbalance in My Stories. Here's What I've Learned and Why I Did It." And the reason I wanted to have you on was to talk about how this doesn't happen. This sort of inclusion of everyone does not happen unless we're really quite purposeful about it. I think, as KJ and I have talked about in the past, it can be really easy to just say, oh, I have a source for that. This person I always go to over here. And so we tend to rely on the same group of people over and over again. I wanted, as I'm going into the hopefully a new book project, and I was so impressed with what you told me about your commitment to inclusion for the new book, I wanted to have you on so you could talk with us a little bit about how one goes about doing that, what the thought process was, and how that looks in its execution. So let's jump in. You actually, could you give us a bit of an idea of sort of why this was so important to you for this book in the first place?
Sure. I'm a Black and biracial woman. I have spent my life not belonging to categories that society has created. I live in the liminal spaces and I'm deeply aware of who else is in those liminal spaces. So I have never been a part of the majority. In my adult life, my friendships and groups I belong to are not predominantly white. And as an author, I therefore am not drawing upon what white people think. I'm trying to make sure that, yes, white people's voices matter, and so do everyone else's. And so it's really just a part of my practice, but it's not, you said it only happens intentionally, and I think that really gets to, well, why do we have the intentions we have? And mine are born of my lived experience of feeling excluded, feeling otherized, and wanting to be sure I don't replicate that in my writing.
Well, and for I say it must be intentional, and it very much must be for me. I live in an extremely white state. I am a white hetero woman. I was raised with mostly white hetero people. And it's very easy for me to reach out to a small group of people that are mostly privileged white hetero or, you know, and so for me, when I say that I have to be intentional about it, that reveals something about me right there, right? That I am going to have to work very hard at it with this, whatever my next project is and whatever articles I write. So it's, That perspective, my perspective, clearly speaks to the privilege that I'm working from in the first place.
Yeah, or not just privilege, but just we all have our communities. So right. It's, you know, what, right. Who are your friends? Who do you know? Who are your colleagues? What organizations are you a part of? And we all tend to sort of speak from our own place of knowing, and that's legitimate. But if we have an intention to not let our place of knowing be this self-referential place, like everyone is like me, I will only consult people like me. If we want to go beyond that, then that does take intentionality.
Mm-hmm. As an editor at the Times for 5 years, so from 2013 to 2017, you know, I had the Motherlode blog, and it really, without a great deal of intentionality, it essentially became the space in which New York suburban, honestly, mostly Jewish writers, women, expressed themselves. Like that, without a great deal of effort, that's all it would be. Because, you know, the readership skews that way and the writership around them skews that way. And when I hear an editor say, well, yes, but all my pitches are from white men, I know that they're probably right. Because I did the math on that, and the vast majority of people who pitched me fell into that category. So I really had to, if I wanted to hear other voices, if we wanted to have them in that space, I had to go and find them. But once I started to find them, it's not like they're not there. It's just that they were used to not sort of having that opportunity.
Well, and KJ and I have had the opportunity to work with an organization called the Op-Ed Project that really was trying to get right at that, which was the fact that, you know, when people started talking about, well, who's submitting? Why are all the op-eds by white men? And it turns out that a lot of the op-eds were from white men because white men were submitting more than other groups were submitting. And so the Op-Ed Project, Katie Ornstein went out there and attempted to really get that, change that playing field so that people who had diverse voices were actually being edited and being supported and having the connections that a lot of other people seem to just be able to reach out and grab and to get their work in there. And so it was a really big deal to be a part of the Op-Ed Project, because that was a big opportunity for me to open my eyes a little bit too, in terms of how closed off I was being in terms of my own reaching for sources and voices.
But things have changed a lot, even in the years since that started and in the years since I was editing. People are much more aware of this. I was a little bit leery of expressing what I was doing some of the time at the Times, because, you know, reaching out to unknown writers in a position of being a fairly inferior editor, if that makes any sense. I mean, I was a woman, I was doing the parenting column. That's like the Times' sort of least respected area. So to also be like, and now I'm going to invite in other people that don't look like all your other writers, felt really strange then. But now, It's what we all should, it's what we should have been doing all along. But I'm so happy that it has become a bigger conversation. I'm not happy about the things that had to happen so that would happen, but I'm glad we're doing it.
And let's be clear that we're talking about white people have changed. White people have changed,
yes, right?
There are a whole
changed.
Lot of us
Please.
Who yeah. have been doing it, who have
no,
been
no.
caring about it, who have been like, this is my reality. And so it is wonderful mm-hmm. to see the shift happening around us. And so I began creating this book, Your Turn, How to Be an Adult. I got the contract in 2016 and it's coming out in 2021. So I've had a lot of time thinking about this book, really struggling with how to be an authority. This is a book for young adults struggling with adulting. Just this broad, I think of adulting as this swath of life between childhood and death. Okay, so how do you write a book for all humans about a phase of life all humans go to if they make it to age 18? Like, how? I don't have any authority on that. I struggled with, I'm not an authority. Who is an authority? What's the voice? Who's, you know, how do you write a book about a stage of life everyone goes through that is respecting of each individual journey? And I knew from the start that I wanted to put a multitude of voices on the page to illustrate what adulting looks like. And I pitched all different methods for accomplishing this. My editor didn't like it. I just kept repeatedly facing rejection around the outline for this book and its structure. But what I held on to was, this shall not only be my voice. What I have ended up with, I did most of the writing in 2019 and 2020, is this, I'm holding up a sign that is my handwritten matrix of all the humans in my book, which is, you know, like they're, you know, it covers socioeconomic status, it covers race, it covers gender identity, it covers sexual orientation, it covers immigrants, it covers neuroatypicality or neurodivergence, it covers mental health issues, it covers how educated they are, it covers what part of the country they're from. And I just mapped it out. This is a map. Because I knew it would be arrogant and just wrong to put a book out there that purports to be for everybody that somehow fails to have everybody, quote unquote, on the page. So these 32 people, of course, I don't have every story. That's an impossibility. But I'm confident that I have managed to find a set of humans who are, broadly speaking, quite representative of our country. And I'm delighted by that. And they bring me joy when I read their stories. I feel joy.
How do you avoid the temptation that so in Gift of Failure, at a certain point, there were chapters that were included. Like there was one specifically on kids who were not neurotypical. And it started to be a bigger chapter than all the other chapters because I felt like I had to cover everything. And then I was outside of my wheelhouse. It was not my specialty anymore. And it was the need to include everything was taking over my core mission, which was to help address the most people possible. How do you balance those two things?
Yeah, it's such a beautiful question. And I certainly struggle with this. I decided that because mental health challenges are so common in our young adult population, that I shouldn't just have a chapter on like, oh, hey, if you have mental health issues. I needed to pull that truth into the center of the book and speak to mental health challenges in places other than the chapter where I'm talking about take good care of yourself, which is about knowing what you contend with by way of your mental health and your physical health and your learning differences and all of that, right? So I do have a chapter that is about kind of knowing your situation, I call it, to encompass all of that. But then in many other chapters, I'm making references to mental health challenges or whatever else it might be so that I'm normalizing it outside of that chapter. That's my methodology for achieving that. And let me tell you what it's like to read a book that doesn't do that. So I was asked to read a book, to blurb a book on boys, you know, boys growing to maturity. And there was a lovely chapter on boys and violence that failed to make any mention of the millions of boys who grow up in communities where violence is more common, you know, where guns are present. And it was, if it was only written for, you know, the straight white cis males who would be in a suburb somewhere, you know, and sort of how they incur, and actually it wasn't about violence. The chapter was on guns. And so it was sort of like what could happen to those straight white cis men, males, boys, if guns arrived in their school. But it just ignored the boys for whom guns are a more prevalent part of their culture. There's another example, talked about boys wanting to shut themselves off, be behind closed doors in their adolescence, and it explained the why of that, but never mentioned queer boys. Never mentioned that a boy might be struggling with his sexuality or his gender and feel, right? And I was like, wow, this is really written for, right? And I gave that feedback to the author and said, because this is another, we're talking about our practices as writers. I have a practice of reading every word of a book I blurb. And if I encounter what I would call roadblocks like that, roadblocks meaning I cannot adhere to my values and blurb this book, I will speak to the author. I will talk it through. Sometimes they make changes. Sometimes it's impossible to make changes because we're talking about a systemic structure of a book, but many will. And then I'm delighted to blurb it. And if they don't want to or can't or don't understand it or there just isn't time, I'm like, I understand. I respect that. You respect where I am and I don't blurb it. And that's a little piece of my writerly activism around the imperative that we try to be inclusive of all, at least the big categories of people, when we're writing books.
There was a Twitter thread going on recently. We're still in the middle of this remote school thing, and someone was talking. There's a big argument going on right now about participation and having your camera on versus having your camera off. And people were talking about reasons that kids may not want to have their camera on, and all the usual stuff came up, like introversion and stuff like that. And then someone mentioned, well, what about the fact that, you know, we're invited into these people's homes, and what if the parent or the child is Muslim and is a girl and doesn't want to wear a head covering? And my head, as someone who cares about kids and education and thought I'd come at this from a lot of angles, that had never occurred to me. So what I love so much about your approach is it's going to help the people who are speaking feel included in your book, but it also gives me it's going to give me opportunities to have my mind and my head blown open again, because I can't personally think of all the different reasons why kids wouldn't, for example, want to have their camera on during the day. I can't put myself in everybody's head, but I welcome the opportunity to be invited in. And so that's why I'm so grateful for.
And let me just say that I read the same thing on Twitter or wherever it was, and I had the same reaction you did, Jess, which was, wow, that had not occurred to me. I don't have enough Muslim females in my life such that I'm hearing about that concern. And I found it eye-opening. So I'm inserting that caveat so nobody listening thinks, oh, Julia's purporting to be like the most evolved human. She's got all figured out. Like, I am on my journey around this. I think I'm farther down the path than others, but I am very much, very much still learning, and probably will be for the rest of my life, about what inclusion actually is. And that's really what we're talking about. I'm so delighted that people, and you know, I'm so delighted for Muslim girls and women that awareness and that reality is out there in an article. And there are innumerable other reasons why somebody might need to have their video off. They might simply be ashamed to have, you know, the interior of their house looked at by others because they're poor or they're struggling. Right. There're just so many things we can overlook about a person's private life is now exposed because of work and home and schooling happening in our homes. And it's, you know, it's shining a light. This pandemic is shining a light on so much of the human experience that maybe many of us overlooked or didn't realize was there or had no reason to need to know about.
Lots of teachers do home visits, and they're always incredibly enlightening. You learn a lot about the student, but now we are being invited. We teachers, I'm saying, I'm actually not teaching right now. teachers are being invited into students' homes. And so for us to impose our rules on how things would go, quote, in our classroom, now we're up against, well, it's not real. It is our classroom, but it's also not our classroom. It is their home. Yeah. And there is a certain amount of privilege in being invited into someone's home. And I think we should honor that. But okay, so back to your plan. Yeah. So you go into this, you have a plan. How do you know? You get to the end. Your book has turned out to be a wonderful
book. Wait,
we're
not to the end yet. Yes. Time out. Before we get to the end, I want to talk about how you found the people.
Yeah.
So, because that can be really challenging. You know, if as a writer, you live in the community that you live in, and the people around you tend to be the people around you. To find people of different experiences can be really difficult. And I would love to hear how you went about just finding those 32 individuals.
So my world is pretty diverse to start with. And so I was, I used to be a college dean. Remember that. I was a dean at Stanford. Mm-hmm. I had, over the course of 10 years, I had 17,000 freshmen. And they represent every facet of human existence, except what they have in common is they all attended an elite private institution. But other than that, they are incredibly diverse in that group. And so, and they happen to be the target audience for this book. My former students are now 26 to 36, which is awesome. Hi, former students. I hope you're going to read this book of mine where I try to show up on the page like a dean, caring about you, rooting for you, giving you some frank feedback, all of that. So as we all do, I started with my own network and kept track of who I had and what I was going for. I was driven by who has the best story. Okay, what story do I want to tell to illustrate the point? Who do I know that might? And it's just sort of these concentric circles. Who do I know? And then I put the word out occasionally, like I'm looking for a really compelling story. And I would let people know, I need more people like this. I'm looking for more people like that. At one point I was like, holy shit, I got too many Californians. Well, of course I live in California, and it is the biggest state. 1 out of 8 Americans is a Californian, but more than 1 out of 8 people in this book is a Californian. That's a problem. I didn't have enough Texans. I had to go find Texans, second biggest state, So there was a gradual broadening. I also put a survey out to strangers. I just hosted a survey online like 3 years ago and asked, are you adulting? How do you know? What does it mean? And some of my best stories have emerged from that survey, which we combed the results of and followed up with by phone calls. And, I have this guy, Jeff, who's in the book, who's bipolar. He's in the chapter on, I think he's in the chapter on take good care of yourself. And, but he could have been in the chapter on when the shit hits the fan, because his bipolar resulted in a manic episode on a freeway. Like, he could belong in so many places. He happens to be a conservative white male Christian who was in the military, who had to drop out of the military because of his bipolar. Okay. And he and I have gotten to know each other super well because he's enjoying the questions I'm asking. He loves the process. I love the process. So I've never met him in person, but I feel really connected to this guy. And that happened repeatedly.
How did you ensure that the survey reached a diverse group?
I asked people who were different than me to share it.
Okay. Because even if you work with a professional surveying firm, you actually have to pay extra. To get your survey. Yeah, you have to pay extra to get your survey results, particularly for economic diversity, because there's a very, very narrow slice of economic people who tend to respond to surveys. So, to create a survey that reflects the population is really, really, really
difficult. So my first
But that's when you're using when you want the percentage results as opposed to looking for stories.
Yeah, my first story in the book is by a kid who grew up in Appalachia, a white kid whose mother was addicted to opioids, okay? And he's in the chapter on fending, how to fend for yourself, because he and his younger sister had to do a lot of fending. And I wanted that story in my pages. And this book also has a Black Lives Matter story woven through it, a black male who was at a college. I can say it because it's in my book. He was at Tufts and there was a fraternity party and somebody got into a fight and the cops were called and the cops came and they surrounded Anthony, the black person, with guns drawn against a college student on his own campus because they showed up and presumed the black guy was the problem. And that story is woven in. He's not more important than the other 31. It's just part of life in America for black people. And I wanted that in my book. Now, George Floyd was murdered. I'm not laughing at that. It's this exasperation. Like, this has been my plan for years to write this inclusive book. Then we have this, you know, latest example of the systemic racialized violence black and brown people experience in this country. Now, quote unquote, everybody cares about this. Oh, it turns out I've written a book that has a Black Lives Matter story embedded in it. Wow. Some people are going to think like that was fortunate. Like, yeah, if you're paying attention to black people all along, you will have been writing about this.
Then you couldn't have missed this story.
Just like I had to have an opioid crisis in there. I got to have a Black Lives Matter because these are our realities. Right?
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So leading back to my question, which was, you know, when you get to a place where you feel like, okay, I'm starting to feel like this is starting to come together as a book, how do you know when you've sort of gotten that diversity and that number and that, you know, I'm assuming at this point during the editing, that number is shifting and moving back and forth and you got way more stories than you could ever use and that sort of thing.
I'm shaking my head because my editor didn't remove a single story. So she agreed that these stories had all earned their spot. I have a bit of sadness as I look at my map because I ran out of time. As you know, Jess, you know, for all kinds of reasons related to family, my own personhood, COVID, I just was slammed in completing this book. And finally, it was like, this book will get done, it'll get done. And I was running out of time. And it was like, it has to be done, has to be done, deliver this book. And there are people who didn't make it onto the page. So I had this amazing woman who's an immigrant from Uruguay, came as a child to New York, poor, food stamps, all of that assistance, you know, made it to college, made it to business school, made it to California, worked in biotech, founded a company, sold that company. Now she's a gazillionaire. If that ain't a beautiful, you know, version of the American dream told through the narrative of a Latina, I don't know what is. I wanted her in my pages. Her name's Sandra Spielberg. She's written a beautiful book herself called New Startup Mindset about how she did it. I wanted her in these pages so badly. And I just ran out, you know, we ran out of time and space.
Well, there's your non-excerpt promotional
essay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That you can actually get paid for instead of having them excerpt from the book and pay
Thank you
publisher.
For that, KJ. See, this is an element I'm not aware of how these things work. So I will literally follow up with you on this to just understand how I need to accomplish that, because that would bring me joy to be able to attach her to this work. And there's, you know, that's an example. So my map, literally, I've got like how many gay people are in my book, right? If I didn't have enough, to me, it's sort of, your answer, Jess, is how do you know, like to the question, how do you know is, you know, I had a commitment. You know, I knew I wanted roughly the same number of men and women, and I also wanted trans people, and I also wanted gender fluid people. And I have achieved that. I knew I wanted to represent the broad swath of things we call mental health challenges as best I could. I have someone on the page who's bipolar, someone who's anxious and depressed, someone with an eating disorder, someone with OCD. You know, maybe I'm leaving something out, but these are, you know, there are so many more things I could have included, but I chose those because I felt, and those are what came to me. I mean, in some ways it was like, I'm going for a good story. Can I ask good questions of these interviewees such that I get the richness of how their identity and background might have informed how they went about getting that first job, which may be the reason I'm interviewing them. So in some ways, it's an intentional listening, and not just intentional listening, but excavating through my interview style, really going to places maybe other people don't go to because they don't think those things are relevant to the story, but I do.
I think that something that's really important for our listeners to hear is this part where you say that you looked for these stories, that you said, I'm looking for Texans, I'm looking for gender binary people, I'm looking, you know, and you put the word out that that's what you wanted. I think that especially for a white writer seeking sources, it can feel really, really awkward or wrong, or we can question
how it
whether
feels.
It's okay.
Yeah.
to specifically be like, well, no, thank you. I'm really, you know, I'm looking for these other experiences. So I just to start talking about how, yes, we need to own that, you know, we want to tell all of the stories. I think that's important.
Yeah. And I appreciate that that's got to be hard for y'all. And I love the fact I do.
I'm just laughing because, you know.
No, I do. And here's what I want to offer. Don't feel sheepish. Like, the wrong way to say it is, I need more diversity in my book. Nobody wants to hear that. Right. When if someone calls me up and is like, we need more diversity in our organization, so will you join it? I'm like, what's in it for me? you. Like, I'm sorry, but, you know, and let me offer this. I balk when people say, oh, these are diverse voices. This is a diverse voice. No.
Right. No.
An individual.
They're reflective voices.
No, wait a minute. An individual is not diverse. Okay?
Good point.
A group is diverse potentially. Mm-hmm. So you have your group and you want to invite diverse voices? No. What you're saying is our group is homogeneous. We'd like to have people from backgrounds other than the one we've got. We want to be inclusive of all voices to create a diverse group. Okay. So what I would say if I were you was something so it doesn't feel self-serving is it is important to me that this book speak to all and therefore it has to reflect the views of all. So just say that. Mm-hmm. And then you could say, like, frankly, I'm overrepresented with Black people in this book. There are more Black people than there quote unquote should be based on the American population. And I noticed that and I was like, oh, shoot, you know, like, what do I do? What can I do? Like, because who am I excluding? Because I have, right? And, you know, I was able to say to somebody like our friend Khaki Reynolds, mm-hmm. a parenting author, I reached out to Khaki and I was like, I'm looking for a trans person who's an activist. It's so impossible for me to remember what I said at the front end mm-hmm. to result in this. I was like, I need a few more stories. I'm underrepresented in Massachusetts. I'm underrepresented in the East Coast. I think that's where I started. I was like, I know this is weird, but I need somebody on a kind of New England-y person. I need somebody who identifies as disabled. That's what it was. I ended up with Lydia XK Brown, who is trans disabled lawyer activist from Massachusetts, transnationally and transracially adopted by a white evangelical couple. Okay. Like all of this is coming out. And Lydia is in the chapter on how to make things better in the world because Lydia's fierce advocacy for disabled kids and neurodivergent kids in a school setting, their advocacy and activism is so fierce and so piercingly beautiful. And their statements about capitalism and defining our worth and all of this, I could barely keep up. And I'm a fast typist. And Lydia's autism comes through on the page as Lydia speaks to me. And we talk about that. And Lydia, so the identity becomes sort of embedded. It's not like meet a queer, trans, disabled, adoptee person. It's not that is the point of Lydia on the page. It's what Lydia has to say about Lydia's work is why Lydia's in this chapter. But you get the perspective of somebody who represents these various communities through Lydia. And that interview just blew my mind.
I'd love to ask one last question, which is, as someone who I know you do as well, you know, you are such a beautiful writer in the space of sort of creative nonfiction and memoir sort of crossover. And how do you avoid taking these incredible voices? You were talking about her autism coming out on the page. How do you take these incredible...
Their autism.
Sorry.
You just misgendered,
Lydia. Oh, I did,
Lydia.
Didn't I? Sorry. Their autism. Thank you very much. How do you take someone's voice and not translate it as if someone were translating a poem from another language? How do you make sure that their voice is coming out very clearly on the page and that it's not ending up as it sometimes can happen it's happened in my journalism before and I've had to catch it and stop it, that it's not my voice coming through, it's their voice coming through.
So I'm not a journalist. I've never been a journalist. I have mad respect for journalists, but I didn't come up through that world. So I don't have how it should be according to journalistic rules, number one. Number two, I liberally quote them, and then I have my own summary exposition, so I'm very clear of my voice, their voice, with their voice in actual quotes, filling much of it. I also have a practice of sharing my drafts with them, which is laborious and has driven me effing crazy this time around because, they don't get back to me. And it's like at the 11th hour, I get this like massive revision. And I'm like, holy moly. But my commitment is I want you to feel proud of the way you appear in my book. I want you to feel 100% confident that it is not just accurate factually, but that it is has integrity as a piece of writing, that it is, honoring and serving who you are. It is what you might have written about yourself if you were willing to put yourself in the best light, And so I give them the opportunity to edit. And, with 32 people, and then there are all the experts I interview, I check quotes with them, of course, but these folks, these profiles are sort of 3,000 words long. They're not short. And it's laborious, and I have a whole chart of keeping track of this and that and blah, 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 but I do it because ultimately how they are depicted I could do great harm if I got it wrong, if I summarized it wrong. And I learned this lesson with How to Raise an Adult. I had interviewed some people who are well-known, and they're in my book, and I showed them what I had written, and they were like, this is just not, I can't believe you said this. And I was trying to serve the point of my chapter, like taking their quote and making it what I wanted it to be. And, this is me not being a journalist. Like, I didn't know what I was doing. I was trying. And I got that feedback, and I was like, wow, you are 100% right. I am so sorry. And let me fix it, and let me send you another draft. And I focus on relationships and trust, and that's what was the sort of marrow. And we got to the place where it was accurate, and they felt good about it, and I felt good about it. And so it's that work of that push and pull with humans to get it right, and I'm all here for it.
Absolutely. I've done that in the past, too. There's a tweet that every time I see it, I have to append with another tweet because there's just a slight – it's not that the quote is wrong. It's just that the slant wasn't quite there, so I have to add this little – anyway. So we've all done it. It's a learning process.
Let's pause for a moment for a word from one of our fantastic sponsors, and then we'll get on to hashtag amreading. Writers, before we get to what we've been reading, let's talk about what you've been writing, or rather, where you've been writing. If you got a pile of colored index cards that represent scenes and plot lines and characters and keep getting shuffled around on the floor while your dog walks on them? A notebook full of pages with half an outline here and a list of things that belong in another scene there? I get you. And I want to encourage you to take a look at Dabble, the writing software that works the way our writing minds work, or maybe the way we wish they'd work. Capture all those little details and big plot lines in a system designed to help you keep track of where you are and where you're going. We love Dabble, and we hope you will too. Get a free trial at dabblewriter.com, and please head over to our Facebook group and tell us what you think. Take it away.
Take it away, me? Well, let's start with our guest. Julie, what have you been reading? What would you like to talk about?
One of my former students has a book coming out, which I'm just so excited about. It's called The Three Mothers, How the Mothers of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin Shaped a Nation. For those of us who are listening, who are mothers, how often are we unseen or underappreciated in the formation of who our children turn out to be? Often, if we're in a hetero couple, it's the father. It's like, oh, he's so much like his father, And certainly a lot of people said that about Martin Luther King. All right. So this book is by Anna Malaika Tubbs. She happens to be married to a famous person, Michael Tubbs, who is the mayor of Stockton, California. But this is Anna's book. And I made that point because the two of them have a baby boy, and he's strong and capable and amazing, and everyone's praising the father. And Anna's like, yo, I'm his mother, and I'm amazing too. And so it's a celebration of mothering and of how we create the foundations upon which our children stand. We help imbue them with strength and self-love. And these women are largely unseen in history. And their names are Alberta King, Louise Little, and Burtis Baldwin, the mothers of MLK, Malcolm X, and James Baldwin. And they are seen on these pages. It is a beautiful literary work. I think it emanated out of her PhD thesis at Oxford. So Anna Maleka Tubbs, The Three Mothers, comes out February 2021. It's a fantastic read. You will learn more about these. You'll learn about these mothers, but you'll also learn more about these men who really played a huge role in shaping our consciousness and our narrative as Americans in the last century.
Oh, I'm excited for that. That looks really, really good. I will go next. I have been thinking a lot lately about, surprise, surprise, about ethics and morality and conscience and all those sorts of things. And we've been talking about it a lot at our house. And so I picked up a book that I knew nothing about this author before I started reading, but I have a book called Conscience, The Origins of Moral Intuition by Patricia Churchland. And she lives in San Diego. She was a MacArthur Fellow, and she had written another book called Touching a Nerve, Our Brains Ourselves. But she comes at conscience from a neuroscience perspective, which is really interesting. It's sort of an angle at from which I had not looked at sort of how we what governs our behavior and how we make decisions about behavior. And I'm just trying to wrap my head around some of what's going on in our country and how people make decisions and where those decisions are coming from. And so this is just one more perspective on that I'm really appreciating. Ms. KJ?
You know, I think I've shared everything that I have. We've recorded a couple episodes lately. I'm in the middle of something that I am loving. I'm a little reluctant because I haven't finished it, so the person might not stick the landing. Mm-hmm. But I'm gonna make a bet on it that Plain Bad Heroines, which is a big, fat, juicy, pretty queer horror novel that also has like. You know, backstage movie stuff and backstage famous Instagram influencer stuff and backstage famous writer who writes a book that becomes a famous movie stuff and an entire massive backstory about a murder in a 1900s boarding school. So many possible things, so many gifts to give the reader. And I'm about a third of the way through and have yet to, every page is a turner. It's really good. So far, so good.
Excellent. Julie, this has been, it's always a pleasure talking to you. I feel like we were talking about this just recently. I feel like you just inspire me to hold myself to a higher standard, to be a better writer, to be a good person. And I just appreciate you a lot.
Jess, I appreciate you. You and I have a history that is probably unusual in the grand scheme of writers, but one I think we both cherish and we understand quite well. You haven't mentioned that we have the wondrous fact of our two books coming out on the same day in April. Your amazing book, The Addiction Inoculation, which I am just so, so excited is coming out. It comes out on April 6th. KJ, The Chicken Sisters is out. I can't wait to read it. I love what you do. I love that you provide this service to writers. It's a lonely thing to be a writer. It can be so lonely, and to find connection and community, to share tips and to guide one another. I mean, we are colleagues, and I'm grateful that you see me for who I am and that you support my work. And I hope people listening, you know, found something they could take away. We're all on our journey to get better and better at this, more thoughtful. And I really appreciate your having me be part of this conversation.
We do love flattening other people's learning curves, and it is all a process of learning. So thank you for helping flatten ours a little bit today. All right, everyone, until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
Hashtag Am Writing podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop. Stop. Thank you.